Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program James Keller. He is a longtime program annotator for the New York Philharmonic and the San Francisco Symphony. He's a staff writer for the Santa Fe New Mexican, and his new book is called Chamber Music, A Listener's Guide, and he will be talking about the book and signing books at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Monday, January 10th at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So, first of all, why chamber music specifically? Why did you take on this book about chamber music?
Well, it is a passion of mine. In fact, of all the different genres of music, it's chamber music that I return to on my private time. It's the music that goes most to my heart, and I think that many music lovers have the same experience of it. There's an intimate quality to chamber music that just pays so many dividends. So for me to write about chamber music is really an act of love.
Now, we do this at the beginning of the Chamber Music Festival every year, but let's do it again. What do you mean by chamber music?
Oh, well, you know, it's a little bit of a ragged term, and I'm always surprised by how many people don't really understand what we mean by chamber music. And then when I think about it, I don't blame them at all, because it can mean a lot of different things to different people. But the way I use the term, and I think it's the most common understanding of this term, chamber music, is that it refers to classical music, concert music, that is written for a relatively small ensemble of performers, normally between 2 and about 10 performers, maybe we can stretch it to a few beyond that, who perform normally without a conductor and with only one player handling each line of music. If you think of an orchestra, for instance, you have two whole sections of violins, and both of those sections are made up of multiple players. That's not chamber music. Chamber music would only use one violin playing each of those lines. And so that's the general idea of what chamber music is. A relatively small number of performers and music that is scaled to be optimally heard, interpreted in just that way.
And so this is obviously a European tradition we're talking about. How far back historically does chamber music go?
Well, it has rather fuzzy beginnings. I suppose we could say that in the beginning of Western music or European concert music, everything was chamber music because things started small, and it's perfectly normal for us to imagine ensembles in which there was only ever one player on each part. So if you go back into the Renaissance, all instrumental music at that time pretty much was chamber music, and only at the end of that period did we start to get this idea of the orchestra emerging. But in the Baroque period, by which we mean roughly from 1600 till about 1750, that 150 years, you find chamber music emerging as a separate ideal of music making. And sometimes it's not very clear when that repertoire is to be taken as chamber music and when it's to be taken as orchestral music. I think a wonderful example, I talk about this in my chapter on Johann Sebastian Bach in my book, a wonderful example comes with the famous Brandenburg concertos of Bach, which we all think of as orchestral music. And we hear them played by orchestras, normally with several players on each of the string parts. But then in some of these concertos, Bach changes his orchestration for the middle movement, and he writes it just for a chamber ensemble, just one on a part players, clear as a bell in the score. He changes his texture. He's using it for an emotive effect of some sort. And yet I love these pieces because, for many reasons, but one of the reasons is that it's such a vivid reminder about how gradual this process was. And in the Brandenburg concertos of Bach, we see him with one foot in the world of chamber music and the other foot in the world of orchestral music simultaneously. So it emerged during this period in the first half of the 18th century. And then by the mid-18th century, the period of Haydn and then Mozart, we find chamber music cultivated as an absolutely independent way of writing music unto itself that's quite different from orchestral music.
Now, we're going to have the privilege of listening to a bunch of music during this program, which I'm very happy about. But let's talk first about the process of writing a book like this in a listener's guide? I mean, it's called Chamber Music, A Listener's Guide. This is not for scholars. This is for ordinary people who like to listen to this music, maybe at home, maybe to go to concerts. And some of the pieces in this book are taken from or started as the kind of music annotations that you've done over many years. How do you decide what ordinary people need to know about a particular piece? Is it musicological, historical, analytical? You know, what are we looking at?
When I set about writing program notes, I try to cover all of those bases. Now, I'm a historian by training and by bias, so I really like the stories. And I find when I get feedback for the program notes that I write for my orchestras and for many chamber groups and wherever I'm writing them, when I get feedback, normally people express the greatest enthusiasm about the good stories. They like gossip. Who doesn't? And I must say these composers just provide an infinite amount of good gossip. They're awfully interesting people, and some of them are truly eccentric and do very strange and interesting things. So there are lots of good stories to tell about the composers, and in this case, specifically related to these chamber music compositions that I've selected to include in the book. But it is, as you say, a listener's guide. It's called Chamber Music, A Listener's Guide. And so another part of my mission here is to help people listen. Listening comes naturally, but listening carefully doesn't always come naturally to people. And with classical music, there are certain modes of behavior, ways that composers write pieces that not everybody can be expected to be familiar with a priori. And so in this listener's guide, what I do is help them bridge the gap to the piece and get more out of the piece. If I can say, listen to this this landmark in the composition, listen for this to happen, then people will listen for that to happen and they'll hear it. Otherwise, it may just kind of wash past them and they'll get to the end of the piece, having enjoyed it or not enjoyed it, but maybe not had a leg up on really understanding what was being conveyed in that piece. So that also is really one of my goals in this piece.
And it's tricky to do that in program notes or in a book because, in a way, you want to be sitting with them and tapping them on the shoulder and say, okay, now listen to this part.
You know what? I've often thought I would love to teach a course in which we could do exactly that, in which we could play a recording of a piece and it could stop it at every moment, any moment, and say, now let's listen to this. What has he done here? What has the composer achieved at this moment? Where are we going? Where have we been? That would be so much funny. Actually, I once got fired from a job for doing that.
Why?
Uh-huh. It's true. I was filling in as a visiting professor at Baruch College in New York. Poor soul, professor of music, had died just the week before the semester was
good
to begin.
Heavens.
And they called me and could I fill in for this course, and I was able to, and I did. And so I had, would play recordings, and I would do exactly that. I would talk, and once the chairman came in and did the evaluation of my teaching, and I failed my evaluation. I said, oh my heavens, what happened? And that was the objection. He spoke over the music and has showed such disrespect for the composers, and we cannot tolerate this. And indeed, I was not invited to come back
because of that.
And you know, I understood her point. I really did. But there are places, there are time and places for everything. And I think that it's very profitable to be able to listen and to talk and to discuss while a piece is going on. And then when you go back on your own time and listen silently to a piece, which is, of course, the ideal way to listen to a piece, then you're better prepared
and,
to grasp.
And then those things that you discussed and that you learned just jump out at you.
Yes, and you say, it's like anything else. You say, how did I not hear that before? How could I have missed that? Well, it's easy as pie to have missed things. And once we hear them, then we're enriched forever with that. And we carry that experience on to our next listening experience.
We're talking to James Keller about his new book, Chamber Music, A Listener's Guide. One thing that I was thinking about a lot when looking at the different sections in your book, and it goes alphabetically by composer, so you're jumping from Bach to Bartok. but it's easy to forget especially in a world where the lives of composers and artists are kind of like the lives of the saints, and they were great geniuses and everything they did was great, that every single work that you're listening to was once a work in progress with a lot of choices and a lot of struggles and a lot of changes, and that some of them are more successful than others, and some of them really evolve into a level of realization that the earlier ones don't. And that's really something that you point out and that one can listen for.
Absolutely. I care about that. There are many examples of that. One of the ones that's dearest to my heart is Brahms, great chamber music composer. In fact, of all the composers, it's hard to think of one for whom chamber music was more central than it was for Brahms. And his B minor piano trio, Opus 8, one of the great works of the piano trio literature, spanned decades. He wrote it as a young man, and then decades later he returned to it and fixed it up. Now, it was a great piece the way it began, but he tightened things, he worked things just more elegantly when he returned to it, and this is a really good example of a piece that is born over a long span of time. And the miracle of this piece, one of the miracles of this piece, is that you wouldn't know it. To listen to it, you wouldn't know that this piece had been had a double genesis in a way, but it did. And so that's the kind of thing that I feel is very important to point out when writing about a composition, and people then have maybe a deeper level of appreciation, something further to appreciate about what Brahms has achieved in a piece like this.
And it also reminds you that the process of creativity that everybody who's working today in any medium is going through is this struggle. Nobody is easily and cleanly birthing great masterpieces all the time.
Well, a few of the composers appear to have done that.
Right.
I mean, the mind can hardly grasp this, but you do have people like Mozart, people like Mendelssohn, who on some occasions just seem to spin this stuff out.
At the age of 12.
Yeah. Well, what were you doing when you were 12? Weren't you writing string quartets?
I believe I was chewing gum.
There you go. But it's amazing that they could do it. But then, of course, this becomes the stuff of legend. So we all grew up thinking that Mozart always did this. For instance, Mozart just had to basically put ink in his on his quill, and he was writing masterpieces. But then when we look at it, as a musicologist, if I look at Mozart's sketches and actually look into these pieces, I discover, usually that really was not the case. He, too, was working these things out and getting the details right and throwing out his sketches that that weren't going anywhere and replacing a movement at a later date. And this goes on all the time.
So we're going to be listening to music in just a moment. We're going to start with Johann Sebastian Bach. But I wanted to give you a chance for a moment to talk about changes in just the choice of instruments that composers were using. So, for example, when Bach was writing chamber music, what instruments are we talking about?
Well, the piece that we're going to listen to is actually a trio sonata. That was a very standard late Baroque agglomeration of instruments that involved two melody instruments, in other words, instruments that could only play a single line at a time, and they're playing the melodies, these two instruments, and then it's a trio sonata, so the third leg of this three-legged sonata is what we call the continuo part, and that's the accompanimental function. That's usually a harpsichord, sometimes a cello is assisting with that, sometimes a bassoon, some other bass instrument. And, you know, the interesting thing at this early phase of chamber music is very often the Baroque composers didn't actually tell you in the score what instrument they were writing for.
So there was some flexibility?
There was a lot of flexibility. It just depended, you know, maybe Count so-and-so had certain instruments on his musical staff, and Duke, what's-his-name, had a completely different group of instrumentalists playing on his staff, and so the commercially savvy composer would make his music available to anybody. So the performance that I've brought in is one that I happen to love a lot by London Baroque, and it uses flute and violin as the two melody instruments, and then the continual complement is accompanying down beneath. But this very piece also you hear sometimes with two flutes, and it's not wrong to do that. And you could do it with two violins, and it wouldn't be wrong to do that either. So we have kind of a loose possibility here that's left to the interpreters.
Well, let's do a little bit of listening right now. Once again, that was Johann Sebastian Bach Trio Sonata.
That was the Largo, the first movement of the Sonata in G Major, BWV 1038, its musicological name for flute, violin, and basso continuo by Johann Sebastian Bach.
And one of the things that is interesting about this piece that you write about in your book is that there's some question as to who wrote what lines?
Wouldn't you know it? The very earliest piece in my book, and already we run into complications, and that's absolutely the case. We know that Johann Sebastian Bach had something to do with this piece, but we're not sure exactly what. It was written around 1730, and it was long attributed to Bach, but also there's a lot of suspicion that this might have been written in part by one of his students, and so maybe he wrote one of the lines and then as a composition exercise gave it to one of his pupils and said, now, what would you do to fill out this piece? How would you write a contrasting line to go over this bass line, for example? So various names of other very obscure composers who were Bach students have been put forward as at least partial authors of this piece. And we go into this and discuss it in the essay on the piece in the book. But Bach certainly had something to do with it.
And as a scholar, with, let's say, in an example like this, you don't have hard evidence in terms of the original documents or whatever. Can you tell by listening to it that it has a different hand on it? Or how do you make decisions about who, whether Bach himself wrote it or not?
Well, this was an era in which there were certain ideals that composers strove to attain. And originality wasn't necessarily one of those ideals. The best composers were often original, and often in composers like Bach or Haydn or Mozart, we hear it and immediately we say, well, that could only be by that composer. But then again, sometimes they were just sort of solving a compositional puzzle or writing a piece that could be used for some momentary occasion, perhaps as dinner music or something to play as the offertory in church or something. And I don't think that any artist is equally visited by inspiration all the time. And so there are pieces like this where it's a really good piece. It's in the book because it deserves to be in the book and because it's frequently performed. And the reason it's performed is because it's such a good piece. Could it be by a composer we don't really know much about? Yeah, it could, and it could still be a good piece.
We're talking to music historian James Keller, talking about his new book, Chamber Music, A Listener's Guide. So we can talk about Bach, we can talk about Mozart. We better not get out of chamber music without talking about Mozart.
Oh, no, that wouldn't be right.
Now, where do we want to start? I mean, Mozart, one of those composers, and there are many, who had a short life and who started composing so very early.
Yeah, that's right. He was writing already. He was composing music when he was six. And it's not masterpieces at that age. He took, like everybody, he took quite a while, a number of years, to get really good at what he did. But he was extraordinary. Yeah. In his youth, he was already the subject of scientific inquiry. He was referred to as a prodigy of nature by the scientists at the British Society. And he was just an extraordinary person. And he wrote so busily. I mean, when you think of the quantity of music that he wrote, there are 626 official catalog entries in Mozart's catalog. And really, that's a life that lasted only 35 years. Yeah, so, I mean, it's 29 of those he was writing music, and so it's really quite extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. And as I was reading it, I keep forgetting how relatively close in time he was to Bach. And
yeah,
there's such a great stylistic movement forward, it seems, with Mozart.
Oh, such a sea change. It's true. He was born 6 years after Bach died. Bach died in 1750. Mozart's born in 1756.
Yeah.
Bach, in a way, it's an extreme comparison in the sense that Bach was already considered quite old-fashioned by the time that he died. He was sort of the old fogey among composers in 1750. During the last decade of his life, he was doing these very arcane musical experiments that only the music theorists and the real connoisseurs were plugged into. Most people were happy to forget about Bach. And so style was already changing at that time, while Bach was still alive and working. But this whole Baroque aesthetic based on counterpoint and the conflict between musical lines and the drama of one line moving this way and the other one moving in a different direction that really fueled much of Bach, that was old-fashioned by the middle of the 18th century. And Mozart really plugged into the new style, which was much more centered on specific harmonic motion. And it's a little easier for us to understand. One of Bach's sons, Bach had many children.
What, 20 or something?
Yes, he did. He had 20 children with two wives, sequentially, not at the same time, right? And a number of those children became composers or composers, organists, musicians of different kinds. And four of them became actually very good composers. And the youngest of them, a fellow named Johann Christian Bach, became a composer very much in the Mozart style. Mozart was a friend of Johann Christian Bach, a son of Bach. And he cultivated this easier style, this more transparent style that was really completely 180 degrees from what his father had done.
And so Mozart certainly was not the inventor of this new trend in music, but he did bring it forward in ways that maybe you can characterize for us.
Yeah, he did. And there's a transparency in his writing that we don't really expect from late Baroque. In the late Baroque, we often, it's like a crossword puzzle that fits together with a certain difficulty. There's a difficult, brainy aspect, an intellectualism in late Baroque music that is very gratifying. I mean, I love this music. but there's it plays to the connoisseurs in a way. Mozart is certainly a connoisseur's composer, but he's not just a connoisseur's composer. He also plays to the pop. He has the popular touch, and he really cultivates that in the course of his career. He was, I mean, Bach wasn't really. He didn't have to do it for his livelihood. He was a church composer. He wrote old-fashioned, conservative, intellectual music because that's what the church was happy for him to write. But Mozart was a little different. He normally did not have, at least in his maturity, he didn't have court positions. He wasn't a staff musician for any monarch. He wanted to be, and that kept eluding him. And so he was really writing for the general listener.
And that's something that is, I think, important to talk about, because when we talk about chamber music, who was in the chambers doing the listening?
Yeah, and it was chambers at that time. I mean, you would an archduke would have a musical party, and there they would sit and they would play. And there would be all these courtiers who were sitting around, and maybe some invited guests, but it was a small gathering, normally, you know, maybe 40, 50. 60, 80, depending on how big your salon was.
Right.
And the music was scaled for that.
Mm-hmm. And then when you talk about Mozart playing for a more general audience, were there, mixed classes at that point listening to Mozart?
There were, and we have a very strong middle class that's emerging at this time in Central Europe, in Germany and in Austria, and they're starting to buy music. Publication of music becomes more important to Mozart's generation than it had been to Bach's generation. Mozart's career, if you read through his letters, it's this constantly trying to get publishers, editors, to bring out editions of his music because people are going to buy this. In fact, we have a very interesting situation with two of my very favorite chamber pieces are from Mozart's maturity in the 1780s. He's living in Vienna at this point. And he is commissioned by a publisher to write three piano quartets. By piano quartet, we mean an ensemble of a piano, one violin, one viola, one cello. And he's commissioned to write three of these things by this publisher, and he writes one of them. It's his piano quartet in G minor, and then the reviews come out, and he gets a kind of a weird, a very careful, lengthy but odd review, in which the reviewer says, "You know, it's a piece like this is really a great piece, but nobody can play it. It's too difficult. The piano part is too difficult for real people to play." Well, by that, he's referring to the fact that the person who usually would have been playing that piano part would have been the daughter or the wife of some aristocrat. And although they were often very accomplished, they weren't professionals. I mean, they just couldn't be. And so what happened was the publisher actually paid off Mozart not to write the rest of those three piano quartets. He said, rather than bring out the publication of the further two that Mozart owed him, he would just pay him off not to write them. Well, again, a miracle was that Mozart had already gone ahead and written the second one. And so we have
lucky
two...
Lucky for the rest of us.
Lucky for posterity, right? So another publisher actually brought that out and also had no commercial success with it because it, too, was too difficult. And the third piano quartet never did materialize, but at least we have two of them. But that really underscores how tricky it was to write a piece of that incorporated great artistry but wasn't too difficult.
We're talking to James Keller. Well, why don't we hear something by Mozart? What are we going to play?
Well, I thought we'd play a part of his oboe quartet. His oboe quartet is, just a little bunch of Mozart pieces that are quartets with wind instruments. And what I mean by this, when I say oboe quartet, chamber music parlance, as with piano quartet.
It's not for oboes.
It's not for oboes. It's not for pianos. It means that it's a quartet of strings, but one of those four strings is replaced by something else. And so in the case of the piano quartet, it was a piano, violin, viola, cello, the three strings plus piano. In the case of an oboe quartet, again, we're talking about an oboe which has the melody part in this, and then a violin, a viola, and a cello. And this is a little piece. It's not a very highfalutin piece. It doesn't make a big deal about itself. It's just good, basic chamber music. And oboists, of course, love this piece. It's one of the masterpieces of their repertoire because they don't have such a great big repertoire. So we hear this often because oboists just love to play it. And it's a rather early-ish piece for Mozart. It's from probably 1781. We're not really sure. The manuscript doesn't give us a lot of hints, but it's about 1781. Mozart's just spreading his wings. He's becoming a grown-up. He's in Munich at the time, and he's writing for a great virtuoso who he'd known for a few years, an oboe virtuoso, and he presents him with this piece. And I thought we might listen to the last movement, because that has a very interesting musical trick in it. It's a rondo, and at some point in this piece, all of a sudden, it is a very radical thing to do. They're all bouncing along in the meter of 4/4. And all of a sudden, the strings continue that way, and the oboe changes meter to a completely different rhythmic basis, to the meter of 6/8, and they coincide in a very magical way. Mozart makes the oboe play its melody in 6/8 against this accompaniment in 4/4. And so you get to this point, and for the listener, it can be a little discombobulating. You say, well, what's happening here? Is it falling apart? Have they made a terrible mistake? And let me tell you, as an ex-oboe player, I can tell you that the musicians can feel the same way at that point. And it's a very big challenge. You just have to sort of forge ahead with faith that you're doing the right thing. And then at some point, after this goes on for a certain number of measures, Mozart brings everything back together into the overriding rhythm, and it all coalesces again. So this is a very odd idea that he had. He was interested in it at that moment in his career. There are several other examples and other pieces of this, but this is the only chamber music piece in which he tries this. So I thought we'd just listen to that one, the last movement, the rondo finale of the oboe quartet.
And you've just done what we were talking about earlier, which is sort of tap people on the shoulder so that they listen especially for that part.
That's right. And I hope I don't give away all the secrets of a piece, but you wouldn't know unless you had a score in front of you. You wouldn't really be able to understand what was happening there.
Okay, let's listen. Thank you.
We've heard the last movement of the Oboe Quartet in F major by Wolfgang Amadei Mozart, played by Paul Goodwin, playing on a classical era oboe, an oboe of Mozart's own time, with a string ensemble called Terzetto.
And we hope that everybody heard the little time change there.
Yes, indeed. A switch, a little discombobulating switch from that put in contrast two different rhythmic bases in that piece.
Now, let's talk for a moment about the Mendelssohns. Everybody's heard of Felix Mendelssohn, but pretty much nobody's heard of, most people haven't heard of his sister. And this is probably an example of, sexism in the history, in the writing of the history of music. But she's somebody who was every bit as much, apparently, of a prodigy and a composer as her brother.
Yes, it certainly has to do with sexism in the history of music and writing history, but also, frankly, in the larger world. There were four Mendelssohn children. The Mendelssohn family was an extraordinary family in the early 19th century. In fact, back in the 18th century, the Mendelssohn's grandfather was one of the great philosophers, Moses Mendelssohn. And then he had a son who became a banker, and the banker had these four children, of whom Fanny and Felix were the most musically gifted. Now, they were extremely wealthy. This family had a lot of money. And so they bought whatever education could be acquired they had for these kids. They had private lessons in all sorts of instruments, in singing and composition, but also in any other area, in drawing, in art, in languages. They traveled all the time. They really were born with silver spoons in their mouths. And we know the music of Felix Mendelssohn, of course, and he's a very favorite composer of mine. I love Mendelssohn's music. But over the years, as famous as Mendelssohn was, his sister Fanny, who was a little over 3 years older than he was respected and known among the upper crust in Germany at that time, but it was just simply not permitted for a young lady of standing to do things like perform publicly, to have a professional career as a pianist, as she might have had she been a man. It was not even considered acceptable for her to publish music under her own name. In fact, there are a number of compositions, songs in particular, that we know now are by Fanny Mendelssohn, that were in fact published under the name Felix Mendelssohn.
Now, that's actually quite amazing. How is it that we know, in other words, what evidence came to light?
Her manuscripts, you know, people could go into libraries and actually, if they cared about looking up a woman composer and imagine that Fanny Mendelssohn might actually be worth looking into, they could find these things in her hand, and it became absolutely clear what was going on. She didn't object to this, of course. I mean, it was for her, it was great to have her music in print. And if that's what it took to have it in print and for it to be socially acceptable, so be it. But she was a composer of real quality, and it's only in about the past, maybe the past 20 years that we've started to get a handle at all on Fanny Mendelssohn, or as we call her, Fanny Mendelssohn Hensel, because she did much of her composing after she had married Hensel. He was a court painter. And so Fanny Mendelssohn Hensel's work is now being brought out in scholarly editions and in some practical editions for composers. It's being recorded, and it is being respected. And as we hear Fanny Mendelssohn's music, we get to appreciate that really Felix was not the only talent in this family. When visitors would come to the Mendelssohn family salons, which were extravagant affairs that took place on Sundays in their home in Berlin, and people would really jockey to try to get entree to that. It was the place to be. People routinely remarked on both of the children as being exceptionally talented. And it wasn't just that they were being nice so Fanny didn't feel bad. They were bowled over by both of them. But then she had to withdraw later on.
Well, now we have the privilege of getting to hear her music right now on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, we do, because I've brought along part of her piano trio. She wrote, she published very little music under her name in her later years. Again, she didn't live a long life, neither did Felix, but she did publish a number of pieces under her name, actually, as an adult. She was able to do that. And this is the last opus number, opus 11, so we don't get very high. It's her piano trio in D major, And I just think it's a really beautiful piece, and it started to really stake a place in the repertoire at this point. Again, on its own merits, not because of Fanny's backstory, but rather because it's a really wonderful composition. So I don't know if we'll hear the whole thing or not, but I thought I'd just launch a little bit of the first movement, Allegro Molto Vivace, and you'll hear that Mendelssohn sound. These two kids were, you know, they were two peas in a pod in a way, and you wouldn't be amiss if you heard this piece and said, "Oh, that's by Mendelssohn." Well, you would be right.
It is. It's by Mendelssohn, Fanny Mendelssohn.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear it.
Thank you.
So we've heard a part of the first movement of Fanny Mendelssohn-Hensel's Piano Trio in D major, Opus 11, a piece of really vast scope and real momentum. It's hard to listen to just part of that. But
it certainly is. It was hard to find a place to fade it down.
Yeah, it's a pretty big piece. Even just that movement lasts about 11 minutes. So this was a serious piece of work that Fanny Mendelssohn achieved. Actually, it was quite tragic. This piece was premiered in April of 1847, and just a month after it was premiered, she died. She dropped dead of a stroke while conducting a rehearsal for one of the salon concerts in the family home.
Everybody in her family seemingly dropped dead of a stroke.
They did. The grandfather, the father, and then she did. And after that, her brother Felix, who
6 months later
adored her, just lasted another 6 months, and then he was felled by a series of three strokes, one right after the other. Very sad.
And yet, as you say in your book, she did not, by any stretch of the imagination, lead a tragic life. She was very happy and contented.
Absolutely. She had everything that anybody could wish for, but she lived at a time that was not really amenable to the possibility of woman composer. That was not an activity that was really open for her to do publicly. And so we talk about this a little bit in the book, and I'm so glad to have been able to include this piece among the repertoire. You know, there are 56 composers represented in this book, 192 pieces, and there's no question in my mind that this is one of the pieces that needed to be in there.
We don't even have time now to talk about the crazy selection process that you must have gone through in order to do a book like this, because there's so much that's left out that you can't put in. Otherwise, it'd be a series of kind of encyclopedic volumes.
That was, in fact, by far the least happy part about writing this book, was cutting music out, cutting out pieces that I love.
But exactly.
What are you going to do?
Well, we've been talking to James Keller, and his book is called Chamber Music, A Listener's Guide. James Keller is a program annotator for the New York Philharmonic and the San Francisco Symphony. He's a staff writer for the Santa Fe New Mexican. You can read his work in the Pasatiempo many, many Fridays. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday, the 10th of January at 6 o'clock. It's just a pleasure to have you on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. We'll be back again, I hope.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.